Welcome to this week's Reaction podcast. I'm joined by Ian Martin, our editor, and Maggie Pagano, our executive editor. This edition is a long form edition. Ian and Maggie have been getting together every day to give you, our listeners, shorter little updates on the day's events, on the coronavirus crisis, on the markets, and all kinds of phenomena. This week, we're going to chat for a little bit longer about a range of things, the whether coronavirus is introducing a new political economy in the West, particularly, whether we can be hopeful about this thing, what the lockdown might look like over the next few months, and the markets, and a bit of cultural stuff, and a bit of a group therapy session to work out how we can stay sane in a quarantine scenario. Ian, your thoughts?
Yes, and we thank you to those who've been listening to the short form podcast. We are, as you can probably tell from the sound quality, which is not bad on Zoom, which I'm sure lots of people are becoming familiar with. Zoom, which is a rather brilliant tool for hooking people up and having meetings and keeping in touch and all of that. Well, we're recording on that. We've also, obviously, like everyone else, we're at home in our respective homes, and we're chasing down if we can still get a delivery that works, some decent quality mics and all of that, so that we can do more podcasting and more of what we're calling those rapid reaction shorts on the economy and markets and all of that stuff. And there's been a lot to analyze on the economy and markets. Well, as you've said, Maggie, it's pretty difficult to reprice anything, isn't it? I mean, they're down, and the pound has done extraordinary things today in a negative way, which I'm not even really sure what that means or precisely what's underpinning it.
Well, I think that's the point. There isn't anything underpinning it, is there, really? No, it's down to the lowest level in 35 years, almost parity with the dollar. But no, I think it's, and that's why the debate about whether the exchanges should stay open or be closed is a tricky one, because it is academic. There is no real price for anything, is there, at the moment? But I've sort of come round to the view that maybe they shouldn't close them, because actually most investors and traders are pretty sophisticated. So once things get, well, I'm not going to say normality, but bouncing along, people will reprice things very quickly. So maybe closing and suspending everything will make it even more unreal. So actually, maybe we should just tick on. And as more people work from home, there'll be fewer trades anyway, so volume is going to go down, obviously. So I guess, I know Andrew Bailey has had his ear twisted by a couple of the big American investment banks or investors, asset managers, to close, but he hasn't made any decision yet.
Yeah, and the thing on the pound seems to be, there's a lot of speculation, is that driven by, is this people, are they running to, ironically, what they see as the safer haven of the euro, the dollar, but then the dollar's doing, strange things are happening with US bonds, aren't they? The US bond market, people seem to be, are they flowing into actually buying dollars and out of US bonds? I mean, when I checked a couple of hours ago, there were major stresses in the bond market. So can it really be feasible that the bond market doesn't trust the US government to print what's required and do what's required? It's all very, very chaotic and difficult to know.
I think specifically with the UK, we've got a very big trade deficit, don't we?
Yeah.
So we depend on capital inflows. Now, if people are taking a view that the UK economy is going to be, you know, stuttering or in recession, whatever, then people are not going to invest. So I guess they're diversifying their portfolios, probably a bit of gold, cash.
True.
You know, don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. People I feel sorry for, and this is I'm relative layman in terms of economics. Imagine if you're starting there's a Italian restaurant that's just about to open, just around the corner from where I live, or was just about to open. What do you do over the next few months? Do you just apply for a loan and hope that the picture that you had when you wanted to open your business is roughly the same in 3 months or 6 months, or do you do something different, or I don't know.
You have to take the view, I suppose, that I know people are very stressed about it and really worried, and a lot of people are in a really grim position. I do accept that, but in that sort of scenario, there's not a lot you can do. You just have to hunker down, take advantage of whatever stuff the government puts together, which is working, seems to be working at high speed to try and put various packages together. And I've watched Rishi Sunak earlier at Treasury Committee, their work, he kept using the phrase at pace, which means they're improvising. It's like a war. Yeah. And they haven't yet ruled out, they are going to have to, they just haven't worked out precisely how, they are going to have to get substantial amounts of cash to individuals to just keep going in terms of buying food and having the essentials and making sure that no one's going to lose their home at the moment. There's no one shortly when the restrictions as we expect become a bit tougher as we get closer to the peak of this thing, there aren't going to be any evictions, there's not going to be teams of people going around throwing people out of their houses. The food supply works, and we have a very good supermarket network in the country. People shouldn't worry about that. They do have large stocks, and if people shop sensibly, and it's now, thank goodness, the supermarkets are imposing limits on numbers of items, and corner shops are playing a big part in this, convenience stores as well. So there is stuff there to get, but people just have to do it in a controlled fashion, listen to the official advice, and the supply chain is protected. I think one of the great ironies in all of this, and we should maybe talk a bit more about what it's going to do to our society, is that it's going to turn our society upside down. So many of those people who have been regarded as low paid, even the term 0 hours contract is demeaning. Those people are going to become the essential workers in our society in the next 2-3 months. And I don't think that this is going to be a short-term development either, because hopefully, even in the best scenario, that this thing fades out after 2 or 3 months and we learn more about it and we fight it and we'll talk more about it, there will still then be the present fear in the summer and autumn, once we've all celebrated that the thing is gone, that something like it or a new strain of it could return, which means we're going to have a plan like this based on how the next 2-3 months are handled in place as the national virus plan. And central to that will be low paid workers who work in whether it's waste collection or supermarket supply chains, Amazon warehouses, all of the stuff which keeps the grid going and keeps electricity going. So I just think it'll upend our assumptions about what matters. And I think any chief executive of a leisure company or any company that's about to be bailed out by the government is going to have to rapidly adjust their expectations of what they should be paid and how they should be compensated downwards. And I say that as a free market person who wants, as soon as this emergency is over, I want the market to be able to do its work to get things moving again and to stimulate investment and get the country back going again. But I don't think I'm being hyperbolic here. I think we have to rethink how the next year or two is going to look economically.
Maggie, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, you know, the head of Gatwick Airports, who sacked or had to lay off 200 workers yesterday, he and the top team all took a 20% pay cut. Now, you might say that's perhaps not a big enough pay cut.
It's a start.
It's a start, exactly. And I thought it was interesting. A lot of people sort of saying, oh, well, you know, this is just Corbynism. We've got socialism by the back door. And I actually think that's a totally wrong reading of it. The state has certainly had to take, is taking control of a lot of forces. It's more as you were saying, it's a readjustment that capitalism, as you and I would support and practice, Ian, hasn't been a free market capitalism. It's been one of cronyism and corporatism and big companies taking all the value out of companies and leaving labour really not rewarded. It's almost as though the labour now, and I mean labour as in work, will start to be, and the valuable labour will be valued better. So I'd say it's a reallocation, a rejigging, but it's certainly not socialism, because human nature, I mean, you're talking about your Italian cafe owner. Well, the minute it all gets back going again, Alistair, and if he's managed to sort of ride through it, everyone will be back there, won't they? People will be going out more. It's the human spirit. So I don't think this is some sort of, you know, communist, socialist takeover type thing. That's some nonsense. It's more that UK has become a company, actually. The UK, and we've got to find a way of borrowing in a measured way so it can be, well, maybe it won't be repaid. And that's the next stage of whatever this next stage
is. That's a good way of putting it. Your restaurateur, Alistair, it's not going to be the case in 2 or 3 months' time, or in the summer, when people are desperate to get out for dinner and want to socialise and see friends and raise a glass and celebrate that this phase of it is over. They're not then going to, because the government, which is the backstop, whether you're a capitalist or you're a socialist, because it's taken this extraordinary series of steps, because this is a once in a century event, we're not then going to turn around and say, well, we now need the government to organise as a restaurant, and we need it to choose the menu, and we need it to hire all the staff and to decide what the signage is and what's approved. There will then be, I'm not sounding like Trump here, who's behaving like a buffoon, but there will then be a load of pent up energy and people wanting to be entrepreneurial again, and people like improvement and progress. And as long as the economy is saved through these emergency actions over the next few months, then all of that, I think, that pent up energy will be released. And let's hope that your local neighborhood Italian can get back into business and get going serving food again.
I very much like your idea of it effectively turning economic order upside down, because it's like that for a decade now, you've seen the growth of a kind of, you know, it's a shadow economy. And from the people I know who've worked as delivery drivers, for example, their testimony of what it's like to work in that kind of role is basically that you're not valued by the employer in a, you know, you're not, there's no satisfaction in that direction. The only satisfaction you can derive from it is allotting yourself more time to do other things and then to earn from the services you're providing. So you are, when you're on shift, you are expected to, you know, it's quite tightly controlled in some of the things that you can do. You're controlled by, you know, measures that the company imposes on you. And that sort of slight, I mean, it's almost an indignity, as it's something that people talk about a lot, that kind of sort of neutrality, and it's just a service.
Yeah.
Whereas now that it strikes me as completely, you know, as you said, completely essential to how you sustain life.
I mean, not everything in that part of the economy is negative, and there are indications when you're in normal situations. I think it's gone too far, but when you're in a normal, relatively normal economy, there are large numbers of workers who like to work part-time and don't want a full-time job and don't want the company being able to call on them for 40 hours a week. So there's that portion of the workforce. But I think you're broadly broadly right about how our attitude is going to change, because they will become part of what, I mean, I'm beginning to think of almost as the NRF, the National Resilience Force, because I just don't, I think people who say we can, it, once this is, we're through the first phase of it, those who say, well, that's great, but let's just go back to how life was before, I think there'll be very little political mileage in that. I think they'll sound mad. They'll sound like the mayor in Jaws who says that the beaches are open, but you know, in Jaws 2 or Jaws 3. So I think it becomes clear then, because this epidemic might come back, or something similar might come back. You then need to reorder and restructure things so that there is a plan that you can activate. On the NHS, a lot of the arguments which we've had about health spending and structure of the health service are going to sound very old world and decadent, because we're having a lesson here and now for politicians of all parties that you need probably 4 or 5 times the ICU capacity. Yeah. And you need, whether it's a TA style model of health volunteers that you can activate in an emergency in case it does come back in 18 months time. So that when that happens, you're not just having to improvise a response, you have something ready to go. You're probably then also looking at a national volunteer service, something connected to care for the elderly and distribution network when this happens. We are lucky that we've got a fantastic supermarket set up in the UK, and we are miles ahead of many other European economies. It's not a Brexit style boast, it's just the reality as a digital economy. We have a very highly developed digital commerce model, and so the economy is more built for delivery, for home delivery and for digital ordering than say the German economy is, which is just the reality.
Well, let's talk.
Can you just hold on a second? Can you make a note of 1724? Can you just cut there, Alistair?
Yeah.
Just my son swearing about school having been cancelled. I just said, shout, fuck.
That's, I was about to tell you that. They've all closing from Friday.
Yeah. Well, have a listen. And then, actually, maybe leave it in. That's authentic modern Britain. But so that was my tip. The other observation I had was that, so spending on the NHS, our model, I think, will change. We'll need spare capacity. And the French today are using military hospitals. Obviously, there are British facilities in Britain as well that can be patched in. But all of that is going to need a redesign and a rethink, so that if you get back into something like this or another wave of it, you activate the plan. And then the third thing I was going to say that's going to be different is that the BBC is safe now for the next 20 or 30 years. Any politician standing up talking about buggering about with the BBC is going to get very short drift. And I say that as someone who's written pieces saying that I think the license fee has had it and is unsupportable. But that's old world thinking. And it is already proving itself as are other parts of the media, commercial parts of the media, of course, and small niche new parts of the media like ours. But the BBC, I think, will be established almost as a national asset in the public mind, and no government will dare to touch it.
Yeah, but it's moments of crisis, they create all kinds of weird news. Well, not that there wasn't a solidarity, but to use the word solidarity, I mean, let's just talk long or short-term alternatives. The worst case scenario is clearly that from my reading of the Imperial College reports that seems to have informed the government's change of, the government's intensification of strategy to fight this, which came out earlier this week. The worst case scenario is that we have to continue restrictions in a staggered way over an 18-month period, as you said.
Yeah.
But just to strike a more slightly more hopeful note.
Hooray!
One, we do not know yet how the virus is going to behave over the next few months. We don't know whether the infectiousness correlates in some way with the virus having a shorter lifespan than maybe one which is less infectious. These are imponderables that we just do not know yet. And if it does turn out that in two months' time it exhausts itself,
by the next year you
understand the virus, you have a much deeper clinical appreciation of how you treat it.
So your point is, Alistair, you can also then use, as they're experimenting like mad at the moment, you can use cocktails of other drugs which can even if it doesn't kill the virus, it deals with it.
Yes, malarial drugs, one alternative. Early generation AIDS drugs are a possibility. There's lots of different things people are trying. But I think it's a subtle point. Or maybe it's not a subtle point, but the reason why we are in this situation and there's this the social distancing that will happen, whether it's going to become enforced, all of that is all dedicated to relieving pressure on the NHS.
Yes.
Because, disease doesn't just happen. We all know, it's a banal thing to say, but disease, the outcomes are all about how well prepared you are. Some countries have done better with outcomes because, or not how prepared you are. It's kind of blind luck. Some countries have done better with outcomes because younger people have got infected and you just get a smaller proportion of people getting into difficulty if you're younger. Italy has terrible outcomes because a lot of old people got infected very fast and it didn't have the resources. If in a year's time it does come back, it is a completely different scenario to the one we are in now.
Yep.
It's just completely different. You will be a much greater, deeper understanding of how to fight it. And we'll, as you say, Ian, we'll have a very different, we'll have invested a huge amount in respirators, for example, which seem to be absolutely vital when people are in a bad state. So, there's a temptation to catastrophize whatever is going to happen over the next month, which is clearly quite a strict series of restrictions on social life. But fundamentally, it's because we've never seen this before. Mm-hmm. And it's a new, complete, all these people on Twitter and commentators who enjoy criticizing the government's response and the way it's changing by saying, oh, look, they're fools. They've changed tack. Are total ignoramus type commentators. And you see it from people who should know better, actually.
This is weird.
To any doctor who knows Public Health England or the people in charge, they understand these people have like a very deep clinical understanding of like epidemic style missiles. And they're not thickos. Anyway.
There's a very strange thing also playing out with Brexit. I mean, who cares? A long time ago, a different world. But there's a strand of really militant Remainer. I see it on Twitter, and I know people are tired and stressed and are communicating their angst through social media. I get that, but who are almost willing it? I mean, they're seeing everything, the government's failures through the prism of Brexit. Almost, it's deeply.
I found that press conference last night, I don't know what you two thought, but I found it deeply depressing and slightly ridiculous when you had very senior political journalists asking, thank God he didn't answer it, but asking Boris, what he thought about his dad going to the pub. He just ignored it, didn't he? But, I think those press conferences, they should just have business and economics journalists and just have science people and get rid of the politicals, because all they care about, honestly. I mean, why weren't all the science editors, the Telegraphs, really seeing a new scientist? These are the people who should be going to these conferences.
I think it was, I disagree slightly in that I didn't think all the questions were
in that category,
but there were a few, weren't there, about had he made an inappropriate comment? I mean, so Boris has got whatever flaws he's got a sense of humour, and I think we're going to need a Prime Minister with a sense of humour. I do think the thing that they've not got right strategy, I don't know. There's going to be a public inquiry to end all public inquiries after this, and everything's going to be subject to freedom of information requests. So we'll know it all. And every politician, people should remember, every politician who's taking decisions at the moment knows that every email, every phone call, every decision they take, they will be held to account in the public inquiry that comes, or just by the judgment of history. And so people are taking it very seriously. But the bit that I still feel is completely wrong is the communications strategy. They seem to have calmed things down now, so that they are, you'll notice that details of the economic plan didn't leak, so they managed to keep that quiet for 4 or 5 hours, and actually a misleading version of what was coming somehow got out instead, which turned out to be wrong. That's a positive, and that sounds counterintuitive to me as a journalist saying, but I just think this is a situation beyond normal story normal territory. You just need accurate, reliable information once a day, then maybe with a supporting briefing. But I think you're right, Maggie, in terms of mixing it up and getting other, some of the science journalism in Britain is as it is elsewhere, is really good. We haven't talked about America at all. I'm not quite sure what to say. I mean, we're in a difficult enough situation in the UK, but you watch that just with horror and trepidation. It does seem to have dawned on large numbers of people how bad a situation the US is in.
Yeah, it hits a city like New York. I mean, in terms of housing and everything, it could be quite devastating.
But as you say, that you're right, Alistair, that people, we were going to talk at the end of this podcast about good news, but actually let's talk a bit more about it now, because you floated that possibility that people shouldn't be too downbeat about it, and that it's not, that's the very worst, very, very worst case scenario is 18 months of these kind of restrictions. But even if it is an 18-month process, you're likely to see, particularly when it's warmer in the summer, you're likely to see easing of restrictions for 2 or 3 months, I would have thought. Yeah.
And the ideal scenario, I imagine, well, it's still not ideal, but the ideal scenario is that, I'm fairly convinced from, and I don't know, from what I've spoken to people who are medical professionals, that it probably will come back and it will become seasonal. But if you can be at the point by next year where you can make it like a bad flu year, which do come around in this country every three or four years, most people can name a bad flu year from their youth, or will remember particularly years which felt pretty bad. You've got deaths that are vaguely comparable, you are in a manageable, you're in a manageable situation, and that's, that's part of life. Disease and illness are, again, I'm being banal, but if it becomes part of normality, it won't be part of normality in the sense that we'll have to do this every year. It will be normal because it will be another virus which does unfortunately kill people, but is one that we understand. So it's, I think, there's also a lot of, again, on a slightly sillier note, there are, if we can, stuff like working from home and the quarantine and all that don't have to be the ends of the world. And I've certainly found that if you're creative enough with your time and you're not at the moment worried about your job, with journalism you can do online just about, then, you know, it doesn't have to be the end of the world. I imagine this will be for 2 months, not 18 months.
Yeah.
But I'm just rambling a bit because I don't really know. I think there's a limit to what we can say about the trajectory of the virus. It's just what I do keep repeating to myself to make myself feel a bit less anxious is that, you know, there's lots of evidence now that there is a huge proportion of cases that are not being captured by the numbers, and a huge proportion of those cases, like a significant minority or even up to half from some sample sizes, are asymptomatic. So
explain to people, Alistair, what that means, and also that this test that they're doing, that they're developing, which will be able to tell people whether they had the virus or something.
Yeah. Well, you can. What that means is that. So, and again, I'm paraphrasing what friends of mine who are medical professionals have told me. So I'm not speaking from my own brain because I don't know about it. But this, you know, it's also commonsensical to an extent. You can have the flu every year but not know it. You can carry the virus and give it to people and be completely asymptomatic. You can have glandular fever for years and not know you have it. It's totally dependent on how your immune system reacts. And coronavirus at the moment seems to be similar in that there are lots of people who are infectious in an early stage, but are asymptomatic. They don't know they have it. If you can work out who is asymptomatic and who has some immunity to the strain of the virus that we see circulating, that is totally changes the game. And that's what the government is putting a lot of stake on. If you develop that, you can tell, you know, significant minority of the population or a lot of the population that they can just go about their daily lives, which again, still tough, still really hard, but you know, you're getting halfway back to normality. And I think the evidence is that this has been circulating in the UK and in, you know, Europe for not just in the last 2 weeks. It's been circulating since January.
Yeah.
So stories going back to December, people who've had this illness with very similar symptoms, but you know, just thought it was the flu.
Well, yeah. You know, a great example, a close relative of mine who, was traveling, went through Heathrow in the middle of January, for the next 3 weeks was suffering from a combination of respiratory problems, which seemed to stump doctors a little bit. It was shortness of breath, fever, even having to use a respirator at night to help on with the shortness of breath, high temperature, took about 3 weeks to recover. Could well have been coronavirus.
Where had he been?
Could have been lots of things. But it's,
where had he been before Heathrow?
Well, he just that it was in mid-January that he went through Heathrow and stayed.
But had he been on a cruise or something?
No. He then departed. That's when he came down with it. Had it for, and he said he was pretty ill. He didn't really understand what was wrong, and it didn't really feel like a, you know, and.
Oh, I anyway. See. He had it on the cruise.
Yes.
Oh goodness! Right.
He thinks he caught it at Heathrow, does he?
Well, you know, it's speculation. But yeah. What that potentially indicates is that, you know. Which is a pretty safe bet, as the thing has been circulating in a significant way for a long time. I imagine, but we just don't. Again, it's one of these big imponderables. How many people are asymptomatic? In China, we don't really know the figures. In South Korea, you see the testing is quite extensive, but again, I'm not sure. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay.
But that's the goals and. That does realistically change everything. So reason to hope. I think in Iceland they've managed to develop something which can give pretty accurate test results on that. But it's, again, a lot. And to come back to a different point, whether there is the possibility that you can be reinfected with the same strain is, again, slight imponderable. And it depends on the testing, which I think in its early stages is probably relatively inaccurate.
Yeah.
Compared to things that are tried and tested. People, you know, don't know when you develop antibodies. They don't know huge swathes of information about this thing. Don't really know who to blame for that. There must be initially, I must say, there's one thing that I've found extremely irritating over the last couple of weeks is in America, you see quite a lot of pundits who have switched very quickly, you know, on places like, I don't want to sound a bit like Trump, places like CNN, people who will go on the telly and sort of go on about how brilliantly the Chinese have done in containing this thing. A chap, I kid you not, said about the fever sort of installations they have, ooh, they're not concentration camps, sort of simpering away to the person who's interviewing him. In my head, well, you know, China has real concentration camps,
yes,
and not so very far away. So something very nauseating about saying that China have got this completely right, and this exposes some sort of crisis. And America's clearly really struggling, and it probably will have a very tough time, but there's not some big global divide here between the complacent West and the non-complacent Chinese.
What do we think?
There was complacency in the beginning in China, obviously.
What do we think, Maggie, it's going to do to our attitude to China? I mean, in the context of globalization, my colleague at the Times, David Aronovich, is saying this is not the end of globalization and the young will still want it to carry on. I just think our attitude is to all sorts of things in industry, manufacturing, food security, reshoring what we make here. I mean, I'm for free trade, but I just think that the question of security and guarding against all of this happening again will be such that we have to that we do end up reordering the economy. But what will it do to our attitude to the Made in China brand?
I suspect that there might be quite a few people who vote differently on the Huawei contract, don't you? I agree. I think it won't be the end of globalization. You can't change. We've always been since, you know, first man on earth.
Yeah.
But we will, key products, key manufacturing, I think there'll be some bringing home. And I don't think it's just because of this, actually. I think people have seen that some of the economics of it haven't worked anyway. And it's, you know, labour has been very cheap here, so actually bringing manufacturing back has already been happening. And, you know, we've got all the designers. People like to be part of the whole process. So I think that was on its way, wasn't it?
Yeah.
In terms of food, I suspect that, who is that supposed advisor who said Britain doesn't need to grow any of its food anymore? A couple of weeks ago, was it something?
Oh, that chap from—it's like saying something. Yeah, it's like saying it's like something from another era. Agriculture doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out it does.
I think in terms of business wider, and I really want to say this, and I think, you know, what Rishi Sunak did last night was, you know, really great for a first start, but there will be more, as we've said. But I think he'll be judged on how quickly and effectively the mechanisms are put in place to transfer either loans or the grants. And I think they'll have to do more in that respect. Indicated there'll be more for renters, the self-employed. One good thing that came out today was that UK Finance, which represents all the big banks, they've said that anybody who applies for mortgage holiday for 3 months, their credit ratings will not be affected. I think that's really important to let people know. Even if you're not in crisis, but might need a bit of cash flow.
Actually, one of the funniest pieces I read in the last 48 hours is a piece based on an interview with, and I won't name and shame the economics consultancy who put up the expert, who said that he thought that it would have almost no impact on house prices, but they would flatten out for a bit, and that there would be a 2% increase in house prices this year in the UK, which I think counts as the most optimistic scenario. If we end up with something like that as a country, we'll be very lucky indeed. And just, I mean, on the economic stuff, yes, you're absolutely right, Maggie. We don't know yet. I mean, I'm watching where Reaction is, for those listeners and subscribers who are tuning in. We're a small business like many of these enterprises are, and we're waiting to see precisely what happens. We're in robust shape, but everyone's worried. I would encourage people to subscribe to news outlets. It's not really very expensive, and we're discovering how much rubbish there is on Facebook. Well, we knew anyway, and we're seeing what Google and others have done to the news business, and go and subscribe to The Spectator, The Times, subscribe to Reaction. If you do already, thank you very much, and please spread the word. There's a lot that we're doing in terms of reporting and analysis that we're putting out free as well at the moment, but a subscription doesn't cost very much, only £5 per month. I was just going to ask on the culture front, and there's loads of culture on your weekend pages, Alistair, and we're going to do more, aren't we, as people are at home looking for things to think and muse on and read that are cultural. How are you coping with the whole being at home thing? Is it leading you to examine other cultural stuff and books or music that you haven't tuned into for a while?
Well, the problem is with the working from home, self-isolation stuff. I mean, luckily last weekend I was able to go out and socialise and see people, but from now on there's genuinely no such thing as a weekend. It's a 24/7 weird
that's critical, Alistair. You've got to make a weekend.
Exactly, but you know what I mean? It's like working, you're in that space where you're at home and you're working, but you're also trying to relax a bit, and it's sort of all merged into one. So you have to, what I found useful is saying, is having a bit of a regimen. Amazingly, and if my old cello teacher, Ruth Beecham, is listening, which she definitely won't be, I have picked up my cello for the first time in about 5 years, and I've had my cello with me in London and wherever I've been for a long time, and it's always been sitting there reproachfully, and I always remember Ruth being really disappointed with me about not practicing and always being a bit, you know, never thought I practiced enough. So I'd like to apologize to her, and also to say that I have actually picked up my cello again. Right, and I've been playing about half an hour every day.
That's good.
And I'm getting, you know, it's a slow start because you've got to reawaken all that, those synapses. Yeah. And
so you've apologized to your old cello teacher. I apologize to the neighbors because I have to say playing more guitar than usual as loud as possible. It seems to be escape.
We can have the quarantine quartet.
No, that's nearly as bad an idea as all these terrible young men in London are going to be writing really bad novels about pandemics.
I did. They're all now doing the Hanfold party app, apparently.
But you did, Maggie, you wrote a really brilliant piece on the site about what to do in quarantine. Alistair, you wrote a millennial counterpoint. I thought there was really good practical advice in both, but one of the things I took away from your piece, Maggie, was the need to create, if you can, and lots of people are in small spaces and small flats, so it's very tough, but if you can create a distinct space where you work, if you need to work at home, and you are working at home, that you can close the door on. I think that's probably the mistake I've been making in the last 3-4 days, or since we've been trialing this Reaction. You let the work spill over into, you're watching the telly and you're looking at it on your phone and you're thinking about it. It's probably best to say.
That's disastrous, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to have your lunch hour. And then you put your phone aside, maybe put the TV on then to watch the news, but you make it a proper break. And I think something else I said, and a lot of people have picked up on this, people who've got young children at home, you know, it's fantastic. The children think this is wonderful. This is holidays all in one.
For 3 days.
Yeah. But what you do is you And I suggested you put a sign on the door and you say, Daddy or Mummy has gone into the office and, you know, I'll see you later. And actually, if you treat people, treat children with respect like that, they respect you too. And then when you come out of the office, you know, you say, hello, darling, whatever, you know, and but follow some sort of structure, unless you're tearing your hair out.
Yeah.
But yeah, and good food is the other thing. Proper food, not snacking, and get up and do some exercises.
Yeah.
Yes. All great.
Really difficult.
But it is, you're totally right. It's the 24/7, both of you saying you have to create. I mean, I noticed at lunch, I was like, a nice way of doing it is preparing lunch and leaving your phone in a different room. I mean, this sounds like I'm an idiot who has no attention span, but, you know, it's very distracting, you know, and hopefully it will allow a lot more, you know, we're talking about upsides, but it's certainly forced me to reconsider how I actually spend my time, because you're really forced into the bare essentials. Like, you can't just sit listlessly scrolling down Twitter because, yeah, you're already bored to such an extent that would become crippling. So you have to engage your mind in significant ways with things that are just around you that aren't anxiety inducing, like seeing fellow commentators completely losing their marbles or people going off the reservation in other ways and all that.
I think you do have to cut yourself a little bit off from the news. I mean, but we are lucky as well. We've got this fantastic technology. It's how we use it. And, you know, don't just text and WhatsApp people. Actually call them or FaceTime, particularly elderly relatives or friends. And that human contact, intimacy, is going to be very important through this.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, I think I've spoken to more people in the last 5 days than I have in the last 6 months. Suddenly phoning friends you haven't talked to for ages the same. They've been calling us. It's really, I guess that is quite wartime, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that intimacy is very important.
Yeah. Well, speaking of intimacy, I've been speaking to friends about, you know, the saddest stories I've heard when I've been getting in contact with people is, it's along the lines of, I went on a really nice date with someone, you know, last week, and now that's it, basically. It's going to be very difficult. But, you know, in distance enforced by, you know, the military and the police might not be such a bad thing. You have to find, you know, this is what I imagine the postal service, I don't know, maybe you could send long emails or, you know.
Letters, yeah.
Letters, you know,
it was very funny. I spoke to a French friend earlier on and we were talking about the different approach and he said, you know, here in Paris, we literally, you can't go outside the door. The police are everywhere, whatever. And I sort of said, well, actually, we've come almost to a lockdown, but voluntarily, in a way, haven't we? They haven't had to demand it, order it. And he's made the point. He just said, well, you know, the French, they never do anything that anyone ever says. And that would, you know, Macron knows us so well, he knew that would be the only way for us to listen.
Yeah.
Interesting.
No, I think because we've been homeworking and all that for a couple of weeks, and certain industries, media, maybe because it's just obsessed by this stuff and is tuned into it, seem to move a bit earlier. You still see reports last night of pubs in central London being packed, but maybe that's just people thinking that they can enjoy it for one last evening before. I don't think that's a mistake. I think that you should follow the advice on self-isolating, but maybe people just want one last hurrah. But I think
Can I be panicky?
Go.
Self-isolation means that one of you in the house has the fever, has the virus. So you're not, none of us at the moment are self-isolated.
Sorry, yes, I see what you mean, yeah.
No, but I think it's important because if you were using it correctly, one would go, oh gosh, who's got it? But that, from what I've been told by them, that is self-isolation of one of you. So what we're all doing is social distancing or just self-quarantining.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry. Important distinction. Yeah. And also an important distinction which the government hasn't quite got across is the distinction between. And the Beeb has been very good at explaining this on its medical sections, is that there is a difference between those who are in a really dangerous situation because of certain conditions, and those who are vulnerable, who have to take a bit more care. And there are large numbers of people with previous conditions or health weaknesses that are not high, you know, they're not at risk. They're not sort of really badly exposed. They've just got to be a little bit more careful, and are just, you know, very likely to come through the whole thing. I think we should wrap things up for this week. If you're not a subscriber to Reaction, we've got loads of people on our site at the moment reading this stuff. Become a subscriber. You just go to www.reaction.life. It is only £5 for the month, and you get the full site, and you get my newsletter, which will be up in the next few days, and all the great stuff that the team is doing. So we'll be back, I think, Maggie, tomorrow with a rapid reaction at some point tomorrow based on what happens in the news. But until then, thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Good night.